Hello everyone, this is Alex, co-founder and CTO of AgentRisk, and this is Between Two Funds. On this podcast, I talk to successful founders who share their stories on how they've helped build great companies, touching on the events and strategies that brought them success, and what they're working on today, may it be building another startup, investing in other startups, or just enjoying life. On this show, we also talk about the Los Angeles startup ecosystem, what makes it such a great place to build a startup, and surfacing what we can all do to make this a startup epicenter. A reminder, the content here is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice. Under no circumstances should any of the information provided on this podcast be construed as an offer soliciting the purchase or sale of any security, nor should it be construed as an offer to provide investment advisory services. The content speaks only as of the date indicated. AgentRisk employees may hold positions in companies mentioned in the podcast. So today we have with us Dennis Mortensen, the founder and CEO of X.AI, which they help people schedule meetings. So Dennis and I virtually met a couple years ago when Dennis stepped up and actually did customer support on Twitter for a question I had as a new X.AI user. So founders out there, take note, this is a serious power move and you can turn your users into fans just like that. So Dennis and I kept in touch over time, and I even had a chance to visit him at their office in Manhattan, you know, back at the time when we couldn't actually casually travel and meet people at other cities. And I've been really fascinated with his approach with building companies, especially the way they have been so transparent about designing new features with X.AI. And if you follow Dennis on LinkedIn, you'll see what I mean. They've been sharing design ideas and taking feedback from users, and it's just a great overall approach in building a company. With that, Dennis, welcome to the show. It's a really pleasure to having you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So we said, you know, at the intro, you know, X.AI helps people schedule meetings, which is a very common use case in the way people conduct business in a very elegant manner, if I may say so. Can you briefly describe how X.AI works?
Sure. So each one of us, if not today, then yesterday, and if not yesterday, then certainly last week, received an email that rhymed with, "Hey, Alex, do you got time for us to meet up for a Diaco at some point early June when I'm back in Manhattan?" And if not that particular message, I'm sure you can come up with one that will rhyme with that. Now, the use case, certainly if you go back not many years, was one for where you would have to flip over to your calendar if you wanted to meet this bloke and come up with a few times, email back, and you would do some sort of ping pong. And there's nothing complicated about this. This is just yet another chore in my inbox for where it is not the scheduling part that really adds value. It is the me meeting up with Alex part that adds a lot of value. So our particular take was one for where we thought if you did not need to kind of switch context, go into some sort of app or elsewhere, it might be easier. So you can immediately reply back to that email, ccnamy@x.ai or amy@yourdomain.com. And the agent will then understand, who are you? Are you a customer? What are your current preferences? What does your calendar look like? What are the particular constraints for this meeting that you're trying to set up? Extract that and read it back to you like any one of the agents that you know would do, and you confirming it will then reach out to each one of the guests with a set of suggestions that fit those constraints. They will then pick a time and hopefully a location, if not dictated, and get the whole thing confirmed so that the agent can insert an event on your calendar and send out an invite to the other participants. And then allow them option to kind of add other fellows from their company or have the whole thing rescheduled and do many other things. But think of it really just as an easier way to get something on the calendar for where you would otherwise have had to do it yourself.
No, and absolutely. And, you know, as I said, I've been an early user of X.AI, and in the last few months I've been, you know, spending a little bit more time doing business development and sales and other stuff and meeting people versus coding. It's been a great tool in my arsenal. I can speak this from my own experience, but what have you seen from the people that have been in the platform for a while? That's what is a common aha moment that turns, you know, a casual user into a fan that, you know, keeps coming back and sticks with using X.AI?
If we were to do the unfair segmentation here, which is that any one of my prior users in my prior ventures, which were all B2B, were sold on the idea even before they signed up as users, but you'll sell a solution for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it's not about the perfect setup or the perfect onboarding or even getting to the aha moment. There was a big ass RFC that we would then fill out and we would win some sort of proposal, a long, extensive period of confirming that this was the right tool for them. We kind of pass. When that happens, you have a kind of different mentality towards your users. Not better or worse, just a different mentality. Now, in the space I'm in now, where it's a, let's call it B2C to B, given that most of our users are operating in a business setting, but it's still a solution where there's a free offering. They use that. They hopefully fall in love. They fall in love to the extent that they start to using it. Might even turn it into a habit. Once a habit, they want access to some of the premium features and then they upgrade. But that bottoms-up methodology versus the top-down I just described is very different. And it's exactly about getting to that aha moment as you described. And for us, the kind of funny thing, and just being super transparent here, you could probably split all solutions into this. There's the users who sign up and do nothing. Then there's the users who sign up, do a little bit, and then disappear. And then there's the users who sign up, do something, and then, for whatever the reason, turn it into a habit and use it over and over again. Our biggest challenge is actually in the 0-1 meeting, not the 1-13, which is that kind of middle period, or the kind of 13 and thereafter, because once you figure out how much less pain you're in, people very easily fall in love. No, it's the 0-1. And the funny thing about the 0-1 is that it's rarely about the product or the solution. What we found is that it's either an unwillingness, not outright unwillingness, some sort of hidden unwillingness to change your habit. And the reason for that is that our particular pain come in small increments. So you scheduling, say in your current kind of setting, Alex, about 1,000 meetings a year, that's kind of what I do as a, you know, founder of a startup. That means I have 1,000 paper cuts. Well, you can kind of survive each one of them. And many people do. And it's only when something becomes so annoying that you kind of choose to kind of escape that. Kind of like if I go back to my last startup, every single one of the offer letters with each one of our employees, I signed by printing it out, pen to paper, scanned it, and they did the same. Today, though, I don't think you signed a contract on paper in the last 2 or 3 years, because we do all of them kind of online. But there was some sort of moment for where, you know what? Instead of signing up for DocuSign, I'm just going to print out another piece of paper, sign it, because that's what I did yesterday. And you continue to do so until there's some sort of inflection point. So that's kind of the challenge for us. Now, to create and to kind of come full circle and answer your kind of question, to create that aha moment, we've seen and we tried a ton of things that the best thing for us and for the user is if they try to schedule a meeting with a friend. Don't imagine it. Don't fake it and do it with one of your Hotmail addresses and then try to pretend to be two people, because you can't kind of close your eyes and kind of keep that story straight. No, the best thing that can happen is, you know what? I should get a Diet Coke with that friend from college. We haven't chatted for 3 months. You know what? He's going to be my guinea pig for this little tool here. Send out email to Tommy. Tommy, we haven't talked for months. I've seized it in Amy. She can help get something on the calendar next week between 6 and 8 for drinks at Tier B downtown. Oh, okay. That's the way to test it. So that's our aha moment. When that happens, then we start to see people kind of at least believe they can escape the pain. Sorry, that was a very long answer, but you kind of hit the nerve or something which we think about all the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it's such a core, you know, email and calendar, which is, you know, at the core of the business, including maybe chat, which I have my opinions about, like I think a lot of Europeans do, but have strong opinions. But it's such a core thing that we stop thinking about it and we fall into this habit, as you say, that might not be the greatest. And we've seen even now in email in the last couple of years, you know, a lot of innovation with especially business email with Superhuman. And then maybe we still have not seen what Hey.com would look like from the other fellow Dane in technology. On that note, it seems to me, if you go back, and I don't know if people remember using Outlook, Outlook came to be having email and calendar. It was the same app. And then it probably was Gmail that kind of split those two apart. And it seems that in your case, you're doing the calendar over email. So the question I've been meaning to ask you for a while is, why is not, or if you thought about it, is why is not X.AI an email client?
It's a good question. I think it's unlikely, if we take a step back, that we'll see single agents being able to do all the jobs you can imagine. I do think it's more likely that you'll see bots or agents or machines, doesn't matter what we choose to call them, be able to do very kind of verticalized and specialized jobs and only do them. So I could either go assemble some idea of an email client, or even what other people would suggest, go assemble some version of a new calendar. Or I can be this middleware that really just exists where you work. It could be that you and me just happen to live in our inbox at this very moment in time. It could be that some salesperson live on LinkedIn and their idea of an inbox. It could be that, as you suggested, some Europeans live on Facebook Messenger. So you should really just be able to have this machine help you in whatever environment that you're at, so that you don't have to take on this chore yourself. And we've certainly seen, as we kind of carried over our software to Slack, that people didn't really think about the channel. They just thought about the chore being the same, but happening in a different place. So why can't you do it here for us as well? And that would then suggest we should create kind of distinct clients on each one of these. And I'm not sure that's how we're going to win. I think, and again, this is the kind of typical entrepreneurial mantra, it is very easy to be kind of half-assed at seven things. It's kind of almost impossible to be world-class at one thing, but you should at least try. So I'm the guy trying to be world-class at one thing, which is just to get Alex and Dennis together at minimal pain.
Okay, so minimal pain, I'm guessing it's your one of your big KPIs, right, in the office?
So we certainly monitor a whole host of metrics associated with the scheduling experience. So I will know exactly when something arrived, once you put in the requests, whether you made any changes to our predictions for what you said it should be, what those changes were, what the thread length might be on the guest end, how the guest might rate the experience, for where we have this voluntary opportunity for them to do so. So that's not a thing which we don't measure, given that we come from a kind of data-centric background, and it's all good and fine. But if you were to ask me as a company, and you and me could kind of hop on this as well, as a startup, I am a fan of trying to run the whole company, at least in the beginning, on a single KPI. As in, your company should be so focused that you can have a big ass 40-inch plasma, font size 800, and you have an integer on that, and everybody knows what that number kind of means. They know what it means at 525 as it is right now. You can feel whether that is slightly behind or ahead of the day. And for us, that KPI is monthly meetings scheduled. If that is up and to the right, everything else will kind of fall in line. It's kind of like, I would assume, Google in the early days, they probably just looked at searches, as in, if people search more today than yesterday, everything else is probably going to fall in line. And for us, that is just meetings scheduled. It's kind of the primary KPI. I know exactly what it was this morning. I certainly know what it was about an hour ago. I know today, at current trajectory, will be our best day ever. So I have this kind of intimate feeling for that metric, and I've been looking at it for 4 years, and I've really tuned into it.
Oh, this is great. And to share a little bit of anecdotes, not from my experience, but from my co-founder's previous startup. So they had a company in the mobile crash reporting analytics called BugSense that eventually got acquired by Splunk. They monitor, you know, millions of devices in real time and so on. So they came up with this single metric that they exposed in their admin dashboard. So let's say you had an app, you were, you know, at that time, you know, maybe let's say Zynga, right? Thousands of users at the same time. And they exposed to the customer I believe they call it MobDex, which means how healthy is your application, how often, you know, it crashes or not, how previous crashes have not reappeared or not. And it was such an incredible growth opportunity for them, because they had, as you said, they visited customer locations where they had those big ass screens with this one big number. They tried, you know, their engineering teams tried as hard to make this as high as possible, because higher was better on that index. So that was like just such a cool example of how you can turn the KPIs around for turning your customers into like really using their product.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I think we sometimes, given the easy access to data, end up flip-flopping between multiple KPIs. Or we see startups, our own included, flip-flop between multiple KPIs. And I'm just not a fan of it. So if you and me sign up to swim the English Channel, I don't know. First of all, we're probably going to drown, both of us. But if we could make it, it'll take us 60, 70, 80, 90 hours to swim it. At no point will we be talking about different types of KPIs. We probably have one which is, you know, exactly how far are we from shore on the other side. And it's not really a debate back and forth on what should we measure here. Well, I just want to live. And if I want to live, I need to know exactly how far we are from shore. And sometimes we can get a little bit too fancy on both what we measure and what we try to kind of make progress on. Doesn't mean you can't go track a ton of metrics, but you should at least track them with the idea that they all help you achieve some sort of increase of the core KPI. So I'm just generally a fan of that. And I think your example is good, because it carried out and ended up all the way out on the customer end.
Absolutely. So let's switch gears from product, which we can talk on for days, and especially with things that have to do with AI. But so let's go back in time, right? So I was reading earlier on your bio, and one of your first, maybe it was your second startup experiment, you describe it as a rather expensive MBA. In retrospect, do you stand behind the statement?
Oh, yeah. It couldn't be more true, because I financed it myself. So I certainly paid for that MBA 10 times over. And there's nothing wrong with investing in your own venture. And of the four prior ventures that I've done, two of them have been bootstrap and two of them have been kind of traditionally VC backed. And whenever you're doing one or the other, there's always a little bit of envy on what's going on the other side. And it's not that one side is better or worse. It's just that it's different tactics for different ventures. But there was certainly a very educational short of 2 years for me doing one of those that didn't pan out as we had hoped for. And the funny thing is, as a optimistic entrepreneur, I still have this lust to go back and fix it. As in, it doesn't exist anymore, it died, but go back and kind of almost play it out one more time. So we've been very fortunate that of the four prior ventures, we had three exits and one that didn't work, but it was a very good educational period and plenty of things that you really took note of. Not as in, oh, that's a good best practice. No, that is a tattoo on my brain for that particular mistake I will not ever do again. Or that was a signal I should have been able to see much earlier. So very interesting. I'm not so sure the day after you surrendered, I had the same kind of joy attached to it, but over a long enough period of time, that kind of arrived. And again, we can kind of have different philosophies for what this journey in general might look like. So there's, for some people, this idea that a startup is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. You only do it if it's a calling, and a calling so strong that you can't live without having to do it. And outside of that, you should probably just get a job. There's nothing, I see the allure to that, and I can see how that sounds rather romantic. But there's also the idea, which I'm a believer of, that entrepreneurship is a lifelong career. And Alex and Dennis are really just running the 50-year fund for where we can probably do 8-10 ventures in our lifetime, expecting that most of them will not pan out as we had hoped for. Some of them will, but it's a lifelong journey. I'm about 23 years in, coming up 24 years on my fifth venture. So I'm kind of sticking to my 8-10 ventures over 50 years. And that's just a different viewpoint. Expecting that they won't pan out, all of them, and that's okay.
Yeah, and it's small. You know, I'm sure you feel the same way. It's just something you cannot not do without. Is something you cannot escape. It's, I honestly, for people that especially you have done this again and again, it doesn't look like any other alternative is kind of a non-starter. It doesn't even exist.
Plenty of people will tell me about their, you know, VC fantasies or angel fantasies or other types of fantasies outside of startup. And nothing wrong with that. But I think we are more like, you know, professional footballers. And I really just play this for the love of the game, not for the outcome. It's not like you and me are on first team of Chelsea. We win the Champions League. And then the next season, you know what? I'm thinking about doing something else. Why would I? I said, this is my sport. This is what I trained for all my life. And I really just do it for the love of the game. And for me, I really just really like the journey. And I like many of the things that most people really dislike. So I like the whole 0-10 people part of the journey. The whole, we have, you know, barely a founding team, a few friends kind of helping out, no customers, no revenue, no capital, all uphill. It's probably not going to work. We're sitting at some lousy print eating yogurt, trying to kind of get a first MVP out the door. That I find almost romantic. As in, that is just awesome. That is, you know, living a good life. I'm going to do that to the end.
That's great. And as you mentioned, you know, we had not just one, but a few, you know, repeat successes in this. And from what I've heard by talking with a lot of repeat founders, one of the common threads was that having a network that they built from their previous ventures can be a huge help, you know, the second, third time around. Have you find this to be true? You know, have there been people that, you know, have reached out for different ways of, you know, helping you out either with product, with funding, with early customers and things like that.
I think that is very much true, but not true to the extent for where you can't get started. I just want to make sure that is at least heavily underlined. It does become easier. So if you somehow end up with an exit of some sort, what you get is some magical entrepreneurial card, especially if you run an exit for where you were financed and you send some money back to a set of investors. You can take that card and go play that around town. It will certainly get you many of the meetings that are much, much harder to get for first-time entrepreneurs. That's the first kind of obstacle that might get removed if you're a repeat founder. The next one is establishing some founding team. You will often have a team in mind, even without them knowing it, so that in your kind of first idea phase, even alone, as you start to kind of map it out, you're thinking about, who is it I should be calling here? Who do I think is ready for another kind of journey? And that is certainly easier because you've been able to work with people in other ventures. Not only that, you even have that first handful of employees in mind for where, hey, that first data scientist or that first infrastructure engineer, that first lead designer, I think I know who to call here. And that is certainly a whole lot easier as well. And it's not just that it's easier, it is dramatically decreasing the risk of a misfit, which is that first-time founders will, again, try to do everything in the book to make a good hire or even find a good co-founder, but you're now adding a sometimes unfair amount of risk that is not visible, which is that it felt like we would be good co-founders, or it felt like Suzanne would be a great first engineer, or it felt like, or when I looked at the portfolio, that Tommy would be a great lead designer, but you don't really know. So that is certainly something for where I've always tried to carry over a set of people from one venture to the next, not completely ripping out the foundation of one of the startups that we've just had an exit on. That wouldn't be kosher, but certainly teaming up with that few people over time that you've relied on in the past. And even in this venture, four are from the, which we started out with, was from prior ventures. So if I take Matt, I've worked with him short of 10 years, or Varun, we worked together for almost 10 years. And as I'm sure everybody will know, when you go pitch for that first $10, if that is the type of venture you run, which needs external capital, showing some slide that suggests that you have, at least on behalf of the investors, de-risks the kind of founder or early team dynamics. Well, that is just one of the things for where they've seen that go wrong so many times, that if you can suggest that we might just die for 15 other reasons, but not that reason, that makes it just a little bit easier to kind of close any deal.
No, I absolutely agree. And then the network part that you mentioned is such a big deal. And we actually have seen this play out really well, you know, in a few samples that we've had. I don't know if you're aware. So we have what we call the Agent Risk Network, which is clients of ours. You know, all our clients are either founders or entrepreneurs or, you know, people in, you know, in the investing space. So we've had people, you know, help them in their ventures throughout the network. So to give you a couple examples, that one of our clients was doing a new startup, again, like yourself, multiple times entrepreneur, and they, you know, doing a fundraising, it's something that's necessary, but takes a lot of time, that, you know, time you're not going out doing business development, building product and stuff. So it's an unnecessary time wasted, essentially. So it was phenomenal for us, success that they were able, just throughout our network, they were able to close their funding round within a week, just by us sending us a few emails to our team, saying when another of our clients, they wanted to, you know, former tech kind of VP level exec, they wanted to go into real estate investing. Again, we're able to very quickly get them the first few customers on that. So we truly believe the power of the network, and we've seen this too. At least a few fragments of that, that works really well. So we get people, you know, at the core of their building, if it's a product, if it's a service. So don't, not wasting time in things that essentially they're essential, but you know, they, you have to put the bricks or something else. And let's talk a little bit, you know, and as we, leading towards the top of the half hour here, let's talk about exes. You know, you mentioned, you know, we've had quite a few of them. And a lot of people read, you know, this is, you know, they just read the summary of, you know, the essentially what happened, you know, X company bought Y startup for perhaps Z million if this thing was disclosed. But there's a lot of things that go under the cover from, you know, negotiating the acquisition, negotiating the terms and things like that. What have you learned that maybe you can pass over to newer entrepreneurs as, you know, wisdom? From going through these exits, making maybe making mistakes that you've done, that you've learned to avoid, and while negotiating with an acquirer, or all those nitty gritty things that go into a lot of this paperwork that essentially is an exit.
Oh, you and me could turn that into a 4-hour seminar, and we would still have another 10 chapters. But a few pointers would be, certainly where I'm slightly more contrarian to that of many of your Y Combinator friends. So there's the school of thought which believes that you should never speak to investment bankers, corp dev, anything that rhymes really with VCs and what have you, unless you are actively pursuing it. So speak to VCs 3 weeks before you need money. Speak to investment bankers 3 weeks before you want to do an exit. That is obviously the unfair, aggressive version of what that translates into. Or you do the opposite. And that's the one of the two bullets I want to add here. You can also turn that into a forever activity. So I will every week, year in, year out, speak to, you know, VCs across the spectrum, growth investors, family office, corp dev, across organizations, corporate VCs, kind of industry partners, the usual kind of top five, so that if there's ever a point in time for where I might need to force an exit, which is never good, then I have people I can call. But also, if there's ever a build or buy discussion in some boardroom at some company, I at least want to be on the list of people they call. Because what happens many times is that you read something in the press for where, hey, why did they acquire these Muppets? We are, you know, further ahead, a more robust solution, and sure, you'll be biased, but let's just imagine it's even true. But you just weren't on their list. It might just be that they were better equipped or better at keeping corp dev or whoever they need to kind of keep up to speed, but you weren't. So I try hard. And if we just take last week, what did I have? Two. So not three, but did two last week. And I'm neither raising money nor preparing for an exit. And one of them was with a traditional VC, and the other one was with a corp dev from one of the top two mobile providers, right? But again, I want to make sure I end up on that list. So that is certainly an activity or a school of thought where you need to pick one over the other. I've picked the one for where I'm willing to invest those 2 hours every week, week in, week out. If you do that, then one day you'll get those calls. And that is certainly what have happened in all of our prior exits, that we never called anybody. They always called us. So when we did the exit last time, it was because I was, you know, casually speaking to the COO of the company over kind of multiple sessions, and one day they reached out. Before that, it was because I've casually talked to RBC Capital, and they then ended up in a meeting with Yahoo, and they were talking about build or buy, and they presented us. That's how that happened. And again, it was really just one for where we made sure we were on enough lists, so if somebody wanted to do something, at least I'll be the one who'll say, you know what, thank you very much, very flattered you had us in mind, now's not the time. We think we are having some reasonably good momentum, we want to ride this a little bit further on our own, but let's keep in contact. But at least I am being asked, not the other way around. So that's my first bullet. If you are willing to make the same investment, try to expose yourself and have those dialogues. And I know this is completely counterintuitive what the 15 other blogs will tell you, so don't take this as gospel, take this as all opinion. Now, the other one, which is if we take closing day, and as you kind of half alluded to, it is very easy just to look at the sum, but try not to look at the sum, but try to look at everything between the sum and that first page, which is, under what terms are we doing this? As in, what is that lockup? As in, do you have the kind of mental capacity to be locked up for 4 years? Because if not, then you should look at that sum and deduct whatever is in escrow or whatever's held up if you're not there for all 4 years. And I certainly looked at the last page on my first exit, but I think the more you do this, the more you look at the terms, as in, what is the lockup, or what are the commitments, or what is the risk of me not being able to kind of pass whatever due diligence we're going to do over the next 60 days? As in, am I sure they are fully aware of all of the details? I think I've been super transparent, but are they aware of this particular risk in the industry? Because I don't want to spend the next 60 days trying to do a due diligence and not see this kind of happen. So I would certainly try to find whatever factors that you really care about and focus on those instead of trying to squeeze out another, you know, X dollars, which really doesn't matter come the end of the day, because the sum will not be so elastic that you're discussing anything between 10 and 300 million. The sum will be, you know, some amount on some multiple on some metric in your business. Let's call it ARR. You'll get your kind of 7x on that. That's not going to turn into 20 or 1. It's going to be a little bit elastic around that. But try to at least tune the other kind of parts that you kind of care about.
No, these are really great thoughts. And I was kind of chuckling while I was listening on your first point, because in the previous show, we're discussing about the pros and cons of having a strategic investor, which, you know, they're very privy, especially if they come early in the round. So that's what happened with my previous company. So we had our co-founder Jay, and we're discussing about this. So it looks like your approach is, instead of marrying your strategic investor, you kind of casually date around town, which might be a good approach. So that's kind of funny. And I mean, hey, it seems to have worked for you. And that's good advice. At least repeated successes seem to have something that works, keep the winning team, right?
So I've always been afraid of getting married to one strategic investor, because if you take $2 million from Apple, you are somewhat spoken for. Even if you're not spoken for, it just makes it 10 times harder when that corp dev team from Google calls you. Oh, so you are married to Apple. Okay, very interesting. Then you might just have decreased the likelihood of that callback, because you're sending a signal versus you dating. Well, I can date anybody I want. And that certainly makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah, this is very interesting. Well, Dennis, as we wrap this up, this has been super great. I'm definitely going to hold you on your words to do the 4-hour or more seminar. I think there's half jokingly, half serious, I think there's a lot of unshared wisdom in some of the very nitty-gritty parts of scaling and executing startups that they're not sexy enough that people will talk about that often. So who knows? No promises, but we may have something more. As we wrap this thing up, is there anything that you want to point out, you know, shout out for any, obviously we're talking about how you're running this tremendous scheduling software that I use day in and day out, but if you want to shout out anything else, here's your chance.
Anybody who, at least up until this point, have called bullshit on AI, and it is a funny moniker, should at least try to go give X.AI a whirl. Sign up, it's free, and try to kind of make a few requests to kind of see how that comes back. We spent years on end trying to kind of perfect our NLP engine, and I'm kind of pretty proud of it. And whatever that response is, shoot me an email on dennis@human.x.ai if it's not what you had in mind, or if it kind of worked. I would love to kind of hear.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, you know, you reaching out to one of my early questions on Twitter, that's how we even got connected. So kudos to you doing this. Again, I'll say this again, it's such a power move. You know, it's, you know, reaching out, speaking to as many of your customers as much as possible, as big as the company is. There's few successful CEOs that I know that they'll do customer support once a week for a while just to get, you know, their pulse on the business. Such a great move. And kudos to you for stepping up on this. How can people find you online? And as I said, you're also on LinkedIn, Twitter as well.
I am everywhere on the internet under Dennis Mortensen. That is the handle.
Absolutely. So I'll put those links in this show notes so people can find them even easier. Again, Dennis, has been fantastic. I really hope things get a little bit more relaxed so we can have some coffee in person in 3D, as I like to say recently. Hanging out with 3D people, seems now it's a luxury. And
that would be lovely.
Mm-hmm. All right. And thanks for being on the show. This was such an illuminating discussion, and I hope we can do this again.
Again, thank you very much for having me.